this afternoon. During these summertime periods when we have the Sunday afternoon talks, there's a couple of weeks where Ajahn Sumedho is teaching a retreat at the retreat center, so he always invites one of the other senior monks to fill in and give a Dhamma talk in his place. And oftentimes the subjects he chooses are quite arbitrary, if not obtuse. And so I'm not quite sure why he picked Buddhist psychology this week, but next week is, I think I would encourage everyone to bring their dictionaries along. As I had to look up eschatology myself. And, he sprang it on me with a wicked glint in his eye. So you can save the anticipation for next week. But I think for myself, the subject of Buddhist psychology immediately has kind of particular associations in my mind, because I realized that about 3 weeks short of 20 years ago, I began a degree in London University in psychology and physiology in the autumn of 74. And so my first association or first introduction to the study of mind was very much through a Western academic approach. That was the experience that I had. And so when I was contemplating what to talk about for this Dhamma talk on Buddhist psychology, I thought, well, should I try and fake it and pretend that I know lots about Abhidhamma, the sort of traditional Buddhist analysis? Or maybe I should speak in terms of the my association with psychology, the understanding in the West of the nature and functioning of mind, and how that compares or lines up with the Buddhist approach. And I thought probably for the audience here that would be a more useful and instructive and helpful approach to make. Also, I am, those of you who have heard of the Abhidhamma, this is the third section of the Buddhist scriptures and is an amazingly intricate and well-ordered and complicated system of, categorization of different aspects of mind and how it all works and how it all fits together. But it's if I sat here and gave you a delivery on that, it's there'd be an enormous string of Pali terms and a lot of confusion at the end. So I'm not saying that there is not a point to scholarship of the Abhidhamma, but that I think for most people, it's much more important to get a sense of how the mind works in a it's a more experiential way, and then to try and use the traditional concepts or the ways of categorizing it in reference to our own experience. Also, I'm an inheritor of Ajahn Sumedho and Ajahn Chah, and also Ajahn Buddhadasa, who are very influential in my own monastic education, if you like. And all three of them have been encouraging to people to avoid trying to understand things through a kind of academic study of Abhidhamma, and to say, you know, that if one tries to figure it out conceptually or remember it all, it just leaves one with a headache and a lot of confusion. Now, if you have someone who is an expert in Abhidhamma and who can explain it and give a sense of what these different, the great sort of variety of terms are pointing to, then it can be meaningful and helpful. But since I'm not equipped to do that, I thought I would spare you all the the experience. Now, one of the things about bringing together, say, Western psychological approach and a Buddhist one, even though they might seem to be far apart from each other, very very diverse approaches, actually they bear a lot in common. And particularly, I think one of the reasons why Buddhism is has great popularity and has great meaning in the West is because of its very scientific approach. It's both Western psychology and Buddhist practice are based on a methodology of investigation, looking, seeing, finding out for ourselves. You know, over the years, one of the most commonly quoted teachings of the Buddha that I've heard and have used is that of the Kalama Sutta, where the Buddha is asked by some people, how do we know what to believe? How do we find out what is true? How do we know which of the many religious teachers who come through our village? How do we find out which one is right and which one is wrong? And the Buddha says, well, you're right to be in doubt. You doubt that which should be doubted. So don't feel that you're wrong to be in a state of questioning or uncertainty, because you should be uncertain, because you don't know. So then he encouraged the people to say, listen to what you hear, see what makes sense, put it into practice, see what leads to happiness and benefit for yourselves. And whatever does, then take it and follow it. Whatever leads to harm or disharmony, to pain for yourself and others, then leave it aside, abandon it. So that was his basic criterion for establishing religious truth, is to take the experience of the individual as the baseline. And this is very much the emphasis of a scientific method, that everything has to be tested and proven, nothing is taken on a blind assumption. So they have a lot in common in that way. Now, the basic question of any kind of psychology is, what is the nature of mind? So, small question, but also a very, very big one. And it's an interesting thing that over the last century, in the Western world, they've tried to develop a kind of useful vocabulary for talking about all the different aspects of mind. But in many senses, people are understanding different things by the same terms, there's a lot of unsurety and unclarity, because, say, the mind is being dealt with often in a very conceptual way. It's like ideas about the mind, ideas about the mind structure. From the meditative traditions that you have in India, the Sanskrit and Pali scriptures, the way of referring to the structure of mind is far more precisely divided up. Whereas, say, English language has a vast number of terms for different emotional states, different moods and feelings. And that kind of area of our life is very highly categorized. The subtle levels of mind, subtle levels of consciousness, these are not very easily referred to. Or if they are referred to, they're in very technical language by they're only philosophers and metaphysicians and eschatologists can understand. So... within the Buddhist framework, and I found this also, you know, very, very, very helpful way of looking at it, the Buddha, say, spoke mostly about the ways of dividing up the activities of mind or the nature of mind, either into the what are called the five khandhas or the six senses. The five khandhas are also referred to as the five stations of consciousness. So basically, the way the Buddha describes it is that there's a fundamental cognitive activity of mind we call consciousness or vijnana, and that can be aroused by different kinds of event. If it's physical, then it's called body consciousness. If it's a sensation, then it's called a feeling consciousness, or vedana. If it's a perception, like a color or a sound, then it's called sanya, or perception consciousness. If it's a thought or a memory, an idea, then that's, say, a mental object, mental consciousness. And then there's just vijnana itself, just consciousness that is not located around a particular sensory object. So that would refer to like refined states of meditation. So those are, say, one basic mental activity divided up into sort of five degrees of coarseness, from the physical consciousness at the kind of rough end to pure mental consciousness at the refined end. So it's a spectrum of consciousness. So that in that respect, you don't have a kind of mind-body divide, but you have a way of categorizing our experience that is like a recognizing that both the physical, instinctive, emotional, intuitive, mental elements are all blended together. They are all in a single continuum. Or else he used the framework of the six senses: eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind. And the mental sense is the coordinator of the other five. It's like the hand with five fingers. That the five fingers, or the four fingers and the thumb, are the actual sense organs, like eye, ear, nose, tongue, and body. And then the palm of the hand itself, is like the mind sense, which is the coordinator of the other five, and also that which perceives thought. So these are sort of the basic models that are used on a day-to-day level in understanding mind. But one of the most helpful that I've found, and that I think Ajahn Chah was very prominent in trying to bring this forth as a sort of the basic Buddhist psychology, is like the most simple way of dividing up or understanding the nature of mind is to sort of reduce it to its most essential components, which is there is that which knows, there is the one who knows, and there are mental objects or perceptions. Like on one side of the fence, there's awareness or knowing. On the other side of the fence, there is thought, feeling, perception, people, cars, jobs, houses, birth and death. That is the basic divide. And if we can just understand and live in accordance with that basic division, and to learn how to not identify with the objects of sense, perceptual objects, mental objects, and learn instead to let go and allow the mind to rest in the quality of awareness, then basically our troubles are over. It's very simple. So that's the end of Buddhist psychology. But obviously the work that it takes in order to do that, or to recognize where we get entangled and how much we tend to lose ourselves in what we see, what we think, what we feel, what we own, what we love, what we hate. Those instincts are very, very strong, profound, and this is where the whole of Buddhist training, meditation practice, the development of sila, virtue, generosity, these are all aspects of Buddhist life which are geared towards helping to bring about that kind of letting go or non-identification with the objects of sense, the conditioned realm, and to allow the mind to take refuge in awareness, to simply be awareness itself. So this way of dividing up the mind, you can also call dividing it into the conditioned and the unconditioned. The conditioned world being the world of objects and perceptions, the unconditioned being more related to that quality of knowing, awareness, or in, to use another term, Buddha mind, the aware mind. One of the other fundamental questions about, or the differences that you find, the contrast between, say, the Buddhist approach and Western approach, is to try and understand what the basis of mind is. Well, you know, okay, you can maybe divide up the mind into different categories, perceptions or thoughts or feelings, or like, say, in Western psychology, you divide it up into psychology of language, developmental psychology, cognitive psychology, perception, clinical psychology, and so on. But this is all, ignoring or not really looking at what do we consider to be the basis of mind itself. And where does mind originate from? How does it arise? What is mind anyway? And this is the sort of question that psychologists hate, at least in my experience. But if you ever asked one of the lecturers or professors this kind of question, you say, well, what actually is mind? They'd immediately start talking about what a thought is, or what B.F. Skinner said about what he thought mind was, or what Freud said the mind was. But these are not necessarily the point. Along with understanding the nature, where the origin of mind is, and probably before that, I think one of the basic divisions is that a lot of Western psychology has focused its attention upon just trying to create a model for understanding the mind. So it's like, how does this thing work? So just like being a physicist or a mathematician or any other kind of science, with a vague sort of understanding that if we know this, it'll help humanity somehow or other. There, a lot of attention goes into how does it work? How does the mind work? And so that it has a sense behind it of analyzing the structure. It doesn't have any kind of other sort of higher purpose behind it. And then the elements of the psychological world which do have, say, a higher purpose or are more specifically geared to that, say, clinical psychology or psychoanalysis, psychotherapy, those are seen as like as a small subsection of the general psychological world. So that you have, say, people like Carl Jung or Abraham Maslow or Freud, people like Ken Wilber, who have taken the basic Western psychological understanding and tried to apply it in a way that it becomes very directly useful to people to help understanding of the mind and to lead towards mental health and to fulfillment. It's interesting, though, that Jung and Maslow, who referred to, like, say, the fulfillment of the individual, the human being, as individuation, or Maslow, who used the term self-actualization and developed a psychology around what he called the hierarchy of needs, being physical needs, emotional needs, social needs, and then spiritual needs as a sort of ascending hierarchy. Both of them basically cribbed a lot of their understanding and their philosophy from Buddhism. I think almost deliberately, Carl Jung realized that he couldn't present Asian ideas, Buddhist ideas, to a Western audience in the 1930s and 40s without using a Western scientific terminology. So he just translated terms like enlightenment and the processes that are needed, the qualities needed for liberation of the human heart, into nicely confusing Western psychological terms. And so there are those elements there, and that those people's, their work of their lives is quite sincerely dedicated towards that same kind of fulfillment of the human individual. One of the things that got me most interested in Buddhism was an event that happened, I think, during the first or second term that I was studying at university. We were having a lecture on Freud, and I remember the lecturer quoting to me Freud as having, he probably said it in German, but I'll quote it in English anyway. He said, the best that my system can do is to transform your neurotic misery into ordinary human unhappiness. The best that my system can do is to transform your neurotic misery into ordinary human unhappiness. Now, at that point, something in me snapped. And I said, there's got to be something more to it than that. There has to be more to the human condition than just coping with ordinary human unhappiness. We must be. Maybe I'm just sort of a foolish optimist, but an idealist, but something said, no, there's got to be more to it than that. So that actually kind of triggered my interest. So when I came across people like Jung and Maslow, and then later on Eric Byrne, Ken Wilber, I thought, aha, these people are talking about something deeper, more profound. And then it was only in later years, after I'd left university and found myself in a monastery in Thailand, that I began to see that what they'd been referring to was something that was kind of worked out and explained and portrayed in a very specific and categorical way within Buddhist practice. So in a way, even though I disagreed with Freud, I'm very grateful that he said that, because that put a burr under the saddle that made me determined to find that, to sort of get to the bottom of it, to find out more. Now, it's also whenever I came across in the years I was studying, the explanation of the nature of mind or its origin, something about that always used to confuse me as well, that there was I could never quite feel at home with that, because from the Western point of view, scientific point of view, they look upon the mind as simply having a kind of chemical or biological basis, that it's a sort of a collection of chemicals happen to collide with each other, and on that happy day when the lightning bolt hit the swamp, a couple of billion years ago, then suddenly a monocellular plant-like thing was produced, and then a few thousand generations later, here we are in the Sarat Amravati. And that that's such a complete conviction that is the sort of the sole basis of mind or reality, just a kind of collection of chemical accidents. That even when people are contemplating the basis of behavior, what makes us do the things we do, or why we are the way we are, the argument was between, well, is it conditioned by our genetics or is it conditioned by the environment? You know, is it one or the other, or how much of a mixture is it? But never considering that there's anything more profound or outside of that. And so that it's seen as very much as a kind of mechanical, mind has a very mechanical basis. Now, on the other end of the spectrum, you have, say, Buddhist approach, and that can be expressed from completely the opposite angle, which is, which you get more in the Mahayana tradition and, say, a Zen tradition, where they talk about something, a quality like universal mind or Buddha mind. Or it appears within the Theravada scriptures when they use terms like the Pabhasarajitta, saying that the bright mind, brightness is the fundamental nature of mind. Defilements are only visitors. Akandu kehi kilesehi. Jitang Pabhasarang akandu kehi kilesehi is the Pali phrase. Morris will concur. Something like that, anyway. Jitang Pabhasarang, the nature of the mind is radiant. Akandu kehi kilesehi, defilements are only visitors. And also in the Tibetan tradition, Mahayana tradition, they make a lot of this. This is made much of. And the mind science conference that the Dalai Lama was at, he built his whole thesis when talking to Western psychologists. On this point, he said that luminosity, knowing, is the basis of all cognitive events. That is the underlying quality of all cognitive, all mental events, is luminosity, knowing, radiance. So that if one takes that approach, and the idea the term Huang Po uses, the one mind or universal mind, then rather than what we call our mind just being the product, the accidental product of some chemical collisions, it's a different quality altogether. It's talking about a universal quality or an intrinsic purity of mind that is inherent within all minds. So it seems to be talking about a very, very different animal altogether. So then it's helpful to consider, well, which model is right? Or, you know, do these two ways of speaking exclude each other? Are they related to each other at all? It's when they say, thinking about this point, even 20 years ago, there wasn't much of a discussion on it. People hadn't really thought on this area very much. Like, what is the physical basis of mind? But now, more and more, this question is being asked in different kinds of investigation. Physicists and biologists, psychologists are working on trying to understand this. And what they find is that indeed, complex behavior can be derived from very, very simple structures, very, very simple, like simple structures with simple ground rules for their relationships can produce very complex and involved behavior. And so that rather than the idea of complex behavior or intelligent behavior being, say, controlled from outside by the hand of God or some kind of universal master plan, you can see that by having a few simple structures and a few basic rules, the very lifelike and intelligent behavior can arise. I came across this very interesting experiment that was talked about in a book about this whole new field of scientific investigation known as complexity theory. And they were talking about it was a conference of people who did a lot of computer simulation of living systems. They were also biologists, psychologists, physicists there at this conference. And this this man who had invented a program called Boyds, which is like bird spelt with an O in it, Boyds, as in a boid, a birdoid. And this program is called Boyds. And in this program, he had invented this flock of little Boyds. And they had three rules by which the Boyds lived. One which was fly forwards. The second rule was don't get nearer than 2 feet to the next Boyd. And the third rule was stay near the middle of the flock. So then they had a big screen and he put this program on and ran it. And it's supposed to be fed in with random numbers so that the actual sort of it's not like a pre-made film, but the actions of the individual Boyds kind of happen spontaneously as the program runs. So anyway, the people at this conference, about 10 minutes into this, started booing and jeering because they thought this is a fix. You know, he's just invented this because this little group of Boyds were behaving like a very natural flock of birds. They were flying around houses and, you know, avoiding patches of trees and kind of separating out into two groups and then joining back together again. And there was even one point where a Boyd flew into a telegraph pole, crashed into a telegraph pole, hit the ground, and then as the rest of the flock flew off, it took off, started flapping furiously, and joined up with the rest of the flock. And I thought, this is a joke. This, we can't take us in. And yet he swore that this was actually just this simple three simple rules had created this whole pattern of behavior, which was very lifelike and seemingly intelligent. And the point of this was that a lot of our behavior as human beings, a lot of the way that we relate to the world, is actually driven by simple rules of that nature. And we think of our social interactions as maybe in a much more sophisticated way than a Boyd with its three rules. But actually, it seems that a lot of our life, our ways of thinking, our ways of relating, are guided by equally simple ground rules. Like, you know, when you talk to someone, how far away do you stand? When you speak, you know, how long do you speak for before you take a pause or take a breath? Simple things like that. That a lot of it, our behavior is actually guided, say, from the bottom up, the simple rules which result in complex behavior. Similarly, if one is thinking from the other way, that oftentimes people can more easily relate to their mind, talking from say the other model I was speaking about, as more of a receiver than a generator. So if we think of our mind more like a radio that picks up signals, that kind of perceives thoughts or perceives feelings. Now, obviously, most of the feelings and thoughts and perceptions that we perceive are generated within our own being. But also, we pick up moods from other people. We perceive how people are. We pick up the mood in a room, the atmosphere of a place. And so even though that perception might be very diluted, we are, say, our mind is like receiving the signals that are being put out by the people around us, the place where we are, the time of day, the season. And so that rather than just being, you know, my mind, which is generating all that I think and feel, it can be much better to think of it, or more realistic to think of it in terms of that which is receiving, that which is knowing, thoughts and perceptions, feelings, moods, coming from inside and from outside as well. Now, whether these two different angles on things are mutually compatible, whether there's any point in thinking about this at all, is up for discussion. But I find it helpful to contemplate in this way. Like, is mind arising from just, is it something which comes from the bottom up? Is it something that just comes out of material substance and how matter works to produce complex behavior? Or is it come from the top down? Is it something that, you know, like a universal quality which our body is just like a radio receiver for? That the physiology of the body is just like a radio that can pick up the signals from around? Or is it a combination of the two? In a way, I'm not trying to sort of say either one is right, and you might think this whole part of the talk is completely flaky, which is all right. But I find it helpful to contemplate, you know, how does it work? Where is it coming from? And to just see how those different principles percolate and how they form an understanding within ourselves. What is our own experience? What does our own experience tell us? How can we relate to that? Now, one of the most significant things of the whole picture is that whether we come to a conclusion through contemplating and figuring things out, or whether we just look at our own experience, what life tells us is that when we experience kindness, when we experience harmony, we feel good. We enjoy being liked. We don't like being hated. Well, unless you're very perverse. Most of us enjoy being liked. Most of us delight in harmony and draw away from pain. And so this would suggest that what we are doing with our life is that, or what is happening with life is that we are, say, when we are experiencing affection or harmony or friendliness, then that is in accordance with the natural reality of things. So if the universe, if our whole world is, if we look upon our life, our mind, our nature, as part of a universal order, physical and mental order, that we are participating in, that we are experiencing, as like a single natural order, then of course the more consciousness there is of that, and the more we're aware of that wholeness, and the more that we get signals that affirm that wholeness, like, you know, I am at one with you, I like you, then we feel good. If we get signals that go against that natural wholeness, like I want to eat you, or I hate you, or I can't stand this, I have to get away from here. If we are following that sense of aversion, that this does not belong, then we're going against that natural wholeness, that natural orderedness. Now, however we look at it, it seems as though our evolution, the evolution and what life moves towards, is that a greater knowledge or a greater sense for that quality of wholeness. That the more clarity there is, the more wisdom there is, the more understanding there is within our lives, then the more we grow towards an understanding of that quality of wholeness. And it seems that that is the basic evolution of humanity, of all life, is a developing the intelligence, developing the quality of selflessness, the quality of what they call self-reference or self-reflection, where we come more and more to understand our own nature. And even other scientists speak in this term. This very hard-nosed physicist, astronomer, called John Phillips, who's well known to be a kind of debunker of all things flaky and new agey and religious, who came out with a statement a little while ago that, as far as he could tell, speaking as an astronomer, the universe was evolving towards self-knowledge. That life, as we develop and as you see within one's own spiritual evolution, or just within the structure of a religious teaching like Buddhism, you know, the more enlightened one is, the more complete, the more understanding there is, then the more of a knowledge of that wholeness there is, the more, say, that if we look at the Buddha as the model, as the, say, a perfection of humanity, then we can see that the Buddha understood himself, he understood the world. They have this term, the lokavidu, the knower of the world. And that as a model for our evolution as human beings, one can see that, say, that is the direction in which things are going. The more life is developed, the more mature we become as individuals, the more humanity evolves, the more we come to self-understanding, self-knowledge, and the more the sense of commonality, communion with other human beings becomes a natural response. We care about others. We belong to others. We love others. Now, one of the things that, in terms of what this addresses then, is that quality of separateness that we feel as human beings, that quality of being alone, being apart from all others, is we can look upon that as being, it's painful because it's not the reality. It doesn't match the reality. In a certain sense, it's real, obviously. You know, we're all on separate chairs. So, you know, there's a physical separateness. But if we take that to be the whole story, then we suffer. And if we realize that's only a partial truth, then we stop suffering. So that a lot of the Buddhist teaching is pointing towards how to cut through that illusion of separateness, or that the perceptions of separateness seeming to be the absolute reality. So this is where the training in Buddhist practice and the understanding of the mind is pointing towards, like, how much we believe in our perceptions and the results of believing in our perceptions in that way, how we are categorizing our perceptions, and how much pain we cause ourselves because of that, the way that we judge what we think, what we feel, what we do, what events occur in our lives, the amount of pain and difficulty we cause ourselves because of that believing in our thoughts or believing in our perceptions. One thing that also went early on in my introduction to Buddhism after studying psychology for 3 years was that I found very intriguing, and it was like a large sort of 250-watt bulb coming on, was that the model for sanity in the Buddhist world is very, very different from the model for sanity in the Western world. See, here, we judge ourselves to be sane if we're not locked up, largely speaking. But if they haven't actually locked us up or put us in, or at least have, you know, we're not dosed up with 30 Valium for breakfast every day, that then we are considered sane. But the Buddhist model for sanity is complete enlightenment. So that until we are a fully enlightened arahant, then we can't consider ourselves to be sane. That anything short of that, we're partially insane. So if you look at it in that way, I remember when this was first described to me, like, well, no wonder the world's in, you know, no wonder we have such a difficult time getting on with each other. No wonder we fight each other so much. We're all crazy. What a relief. You know, if we were all sane, then there would really be cause to worry. You know, if this world was populated by completely sane human beings, then, I think it would be, there'd be a cause for alarm and a lot of distress. But if you instead think, well, the world is largely populated, 99.99999% of its human population are deranged. Therefore, we do pretty well, I think. You know, if you look through a newspaper, it's amazing how few people got murdered. Yeah. How small the problems are in the educational institutions, how few children, fight with each other, and how much marital fidelity there is, how long marriages last. It's incredible. Just by switching our perceptions around, and I'm not just trying to be facetious, I mean, this is a very serious conditioning that we have within our minds, that it just seems so normal to us that we don't even think about it. But if you think, well, I'm crazy, of course, you know, I have problems getting on with my neighbor, well, of course, you know, I have difficulty with my children, well, of course, you know, I just find myself worrying about absolutely nothing all day long, well, I'm supposed to, I'm crazy. This is the kind of thing that crazy people do, therefore I'm all right. Now, it may seem kind of facetious to talk in this way, but for myself, having a different model presented in this way was an amazing relief. I thought, oh, right. Aha. That makes things look very, very different. And you realize it was rather like, you know, deciding that you want to train yourself in high jump, and then you set the bar at, 6'6". And you realize you've been running at a bar at 6'6", and then failing over and over again, day after day, week after week, month after month, year after year, and feeling like a complete fool and an idiot, incompetent high jumper. But if you want to learn, then you start out with the bar at about 3 feet. Or if you want to play the piano, how many days do you have to go by playing bad notes until you can knock out a Rachmaninoff concerto without looking at the music? You know, it's a long, long time and a lot of dud notes. So if we look at our own life in the same way, then it starts to be a lot easier to accommodate what we call our failures, what we call the wrong things about the people around us, all the stuff that we blame our parents and our children and our spouses and all the people around us for. You know, if you begin to look in a different way, then we start to become a lot more compassionate towards ourselves and towards others, a lot more accommodating. You know, if you were living in a mental hospital, you'd have a bit more sort of, you know, if you think of yourself as a nurse in a mental hospital, and you're surrounded by people who are labeled, crazy, this is a crazy person, then you're expecting kind of weird and irresponsible and irrational behavior. You know, the way we frame it makes a big difference. Now, on the level of understanding and how to develop, a way out of that, the belief in the perceptions in this way, and to evolve towards a more kind of clear and balanced way of living. You know, it's important to recognize that this is exactly what the Buddhist teachings are for. Because even though some of the Buddhist teachings do get used in the same way as much of Western psychology in just being a kind of how it works type book, that sort of a kind of explanation. And I think that's where Ajahn Chah and Ajahn Buddhadasa are pointing at the Abhidhamma in particular, very much becomes a sort of a manual that describes how it works, but is so involved and intricate that it really is very hard for ordinary human beings to use it. You know, it's rather like, you know, you want to learn how to write a letter on a word processor, and you open up a book and it's got, you know, the kind of the electromechanics of the microchip, and the you don't need to know that in order to be able to write a letter. So that even though some of Buddhist teachings do get used in that way of just being a kind of analysis of the system, most of it is very much purpose-oriented. It has a direct purpose, and that's why the Buddha gave this example of the handful of leaves, of saying that when he was walking through a forest with a number of his disciples, and he picked up a handful of dead leaves from the forest floor and said, "Which do you think is more, the number of leaves in my hand or the number of leaves on the trees?" Said to him, "Well, of course, the number of leaves in your hand is very small. The number of leaves on the trees is vast." He said, "Well, so too, that which I understand is vast, but that which I explain to you is very, very small. I explain to you only the essential truths." And so that the Buddha wasn't being stingy, even though one might say, "Well, I'd really like to know. Yeah, how can I find out?" You know, that the Buddha wasn't being stingy, he was being pragmatic. And the Buddhist teaching, the Buddhist approach towards psychology attempts to be as pragmatic as possible. It speaks of that which is conducive to our own happiness of heart, our own liberation. Now what, when I was filling in for Ajahn Sumedho a few weeks ago, one of the points we were talking about was the basis of mental health. And what causes us to be able to be liberated? Now, from the Buddhist perspective, the Eightfold Path is a traditional way of speaking of that which leads us from our states of confusion and ignorance and self-centeredness to pure happiness and freedom. That's the sort of the synopsis is the Eightfold Path. So some of this relates to external aspects like the action and speech, and so on, livelihood. And of these, the principal elements that the Buddha spoke of as things that we say we take as our beginning for the path are the qualities of generosity and virtue, dana and sila. But this, from the Buddhist perspective, this is the basis of mental health, is generosity and virtue. So that at least on the most basic practical level, we learn how not to think about me first. Because unhappiness comes from selfishness, self-centeredness. And the Eightfold Path is geared directly at breaking through self-centeredness. If we can recognize selflessness, then there's happiness right there. If our life is based around the sense of self, then we'll always experience unhappiness to some degree. We have to, for the reasons I was describing before, because I am not the whole story. The ego is not the center of the universe, even though it might be convinced that it is. So that when we talk about our, say, development as human beings and our, say, maturation, fulfillment, from the Buddhist perspective, this is based on dana and sila. That this is, if one lives in a way which is unselfish, giving our attention, our time, our friendship, as well as material things for the welfare of others, then this creates a sort of a groundswell, a direction, an attitude that sets the right tone. It brings our heart into accord with the reality of nature, of Dhamma. Now, the process that the Buddha outlined, as I thought I'd probably be talking about this, I brought along my little book of quotable quotes. And this is the way that the Buddha described this in one of the suttas. Talking to the monks, he said, "It is in accordance with nature that for one who is virtuous and follows the moral discipline, freedom from remorse arises. For one who is free from remorse, satisfaction arises. For one who is satisfied, joy arises. For one who is joyous, the body is relaxed. One whose body is relaxed feels contentment, deep contentment. The one who is contented, their mind is easily concentrated. The one who is concentrated understands and sees things really as they really are. One who understands and sees things as they really are thus becomes dispassionate, detached. Thus it is in accordance with nature that one who is dispassionate and not attached will experience the knowledge and insight of liberation." So that's the fundamental process that the Buddha talked about. So based on virtue, then that leads to freedom from remorse, which leads to a kind of enthusiasm. When he says joy arises, that's like a natural sense of enjoyment, of a kind of positivity. And then if one has a positive attitude, then the mind becomes kind of relaxed and easy. The body relaxes. The mind relaxes. This means it's because if we're not living in a way which is destructive to ourselves or to others, we've got nothing to feel bad about. You know, it's not as though where Western psychology often avoids the whole sort of behavioral element. It goes more into a model of, well, just do whatever you feel like doing, live the way that ever you want to live, and then use the therapy and the principles to get over the results of what you do and the results of what you've been doing for the rest of your life. Whereas this model is much more talking about, well, okay, you've made mistakes in the past, but right now, at least you can not be doing anything which adds to the confusion that's already there. To live in a way which is blameless is to allow things to settle down, to not be introducing turbulence and confusion or confusing feelings into the mind. So then, when that's the case, then we become much more at ease with the present. Because if I'm uncomfortable, if my mind is filled with guilt and remorse and unhappiness, then of course I want to be somewhere else. Here is no good. I don't like Amravati, I don't like you, and I don't like anything. I've got to go somewhere else. I've got to move house, change country, change religion, leave the monastic life, become a Christian. Because I'm feeling unsettled and out of order, therefore I feel like I've got to get away from this place. If I feel settled and everything is more peaceful or calm within, then the result is, oh, this place is all right. These people, I like these people. I like being a monk. I like England, even if it is freezing cold and it's grey and wet. So that we change the way that we perceive things and the way we react to them. So that if we're content with the present, the mind isn't racing off to go here, there, and everywhere, which means it's much easier to develop samadhi, to develop concentration. If this place is all right, why do we need to race off anywhere else? If the here and now is comfortable, what's the urgency to get somewhere else? And then when the mind is concentrated, then naturally it's like holding a camera still. You know, the picture clears, you can understand, you can begin to see how life works. We see what brings happiness, we see what brings unhappiness, we see what makes people tick, different personalities, different events, different moods, we see them coming and going. So therefore, what that means is that we're much more able to live harmoniously with the different events that occur. We're able to flow with the changes. We're able to accommodate painfulness and success and failure. We're able to just allow ourselves to rest in that quality of knowing or awareness that I was talking about in the beginning. And that quality of awareness, this is where the Buddha is talking about dispassion, detachment. It's exactly that quality. It's like if we're able to see success and failure, praise and criticism, good fortune, bad fortune, coming and going, without reacting to it, then this is what we mean by dispassion or detachment. It's not that we hate it or we don't like it. We're just not confused by it. Like, oh, look at that. Success. They gave me a good review. Oh, look at that. I got panned. Oh, well, that's life. Some you win, some you lose, some get rained out. And so then that is what we mean by liberation. The heart is at peace with all things. And we're able to respond to the different events of life with ease and clarity and without confusion. Now, it's been very commonly stated in the last few years. There's a sort of catchphrase that has arisen in the psychotherapeutic world, particularly coming out of the transpersonal psychology movement of, you've got to be somebody before you can be nobody. Ken Wilber wrote an article in The Middle Way a number of years ago called In Praise of Ego. And talking about it in terms of, well, Western psychology talks about the neurotic end of the spectrum where you've got to get a sense of self. You haven't even got a sense of self together. So that it's talking about trying to establish a sense of self. Whereas Buddhism is talking about the other end of the spectrum where you've already got a sense of self and now you need to transcend it. Rather like a chick, an egg is fertilized and then the chick forms in the chicken's womb and the egg forms around it. And then when the egg is born, if the chick stays inside the egg, then it suffocates. So it has to break through the egg. And the ego is representative of that shell. If it doesn't break through, then it won't be free. It won't be able to live its own life. And this is a fair enough model in some ways, and it fits very nicely that, yeah, it's better to have ordinary human unhappiness than neurotic misery. True. But, and I think this is another crucial point, along with the redefining our way of talking about sanity, this is one of the other crucial thing that Buddhist psychology has got to offer to the West is that if you notice that whole process I was describing with generosity, virtue, freedom from remorse and so on, concentration, knowledge and vision of the way things are and liberation, nowhere in that process is there an ego mentioned. There's no atta, no self. Is mentioned in that, and this is the sort of the crucial insight really, and what is essential condition, the sine qua non of Buddhist psychology is the insight into selflessness, because we can go from complete and abject confusion to enlightenment without the establishment of a sense of self. But that's not a crucial element. Now, what we call, a healthy ego is more, from my limited understanding of both Western psychology and Buddhism, I would say that what we're talking about, when a Western psychologist or psychotherapist is talking about a healthy ego, what we really mean is just a presence of self-esteem. I feel okay. This is okay. This is not unbearable. I can bear it. This is okay. I feel good about myself. There's self-esteem. There's comfort with our own life. So that quality of self-esteem or comfort is just the same as freedom from remorse. It's just the same as the relaxation of the body, the feeling of enthusiasm for life, interest in life. It's like that's all it is. It doesn't mean to say I am okay. I love myself. I am happy about myself. Not that that's bad in its intrinsically, but that I element doesn't have to be in there. I don't know if this is making sense, but to me this is a very crucial contrast between the Buddhist approach and the Western approach, because what you find that even with in the best and most well-formed and well-established Western therapeutic methods and ways of speaking, You're talking in the Jungian terms of individuation or self-actualization. However one talks, even when one, say, gets to the end of that process, or one is sort of, there's a full maturity in that, still that is conceived in terms of, I am okay. At last I'm okay. Everything is all right. I am okay. And that the presence of that concept of I am, the I element, will, unless we recognize that as a relative truth, as a half truth, will always bring us to some element of the quality of separateness, unhappiness, alienation. It has to. It's intrinsic. If the sense of self, even in the most subtle form, is given any kind of absoluteness, any kind of solidity, then there is still that quality of division, separateness, subtle forms of unhappiness and distance. And there's another sutta. This is one from the Majjhima Nikaya called the Panchatāya Sutta, which I thought I might kind of read to finish things off, which speaks about this, where the Buddha is talking about someone who has developed the path and who is very accomplished in meditation, but yet is still held within the grip of the self illusion. In this case, some monk or Brahmin, with the relinquishing of views based on the past and the future, no way resolving their minds on sensual desire, they see thus, I am at peace, I have attained Nibbana, I am without clinging. Bhikkhus, a Tathagata understands that certainly this Venerable One affirms the way directed to Nibbana, yet there is clinging. Clinging to a view based on the past or the future, to the happiness of seclusion or to non-material pleasure or to different kinds of feeling. For when he sees thus, I am at peace, I have attained Nibbana, I am without clinging, that itself proclaims the clinging that he has. Knowing that this is conditioned and gross, but that there is the cessation of formations, the Tathagata, seeing the escape, has gone beyond it all. The supreme state of peace that is unsurpassable has been discovered by the Tathagata, that is to say, liberation through not clinging, by knowing as they are the origination, the disappearance, the gratification, the danger, and the escape in the case of the six bases of contact, the six senses. So what that means is that even if your mind is kind of blazingly clear and peaceful and bright, if there's the thought, I've made it, or thank goodness that's over, at last I'm free, in the background you'll hear the clank of the door and the key being thrown away, because that very self-illusion, that is the great gift of the insight into the self-illusion, is the great gift of the Buddha to the Western world. Because even if one says, well, we know the ego is just a psychological structure, until we actually apply ourselves to meditation and learn to identify that quality of self and penetrate it with insight and understand what that is and let go of it, like the Buddha describes, to recognize the gratification, the danger, and the escape, to know the feeling of I, a healthy I is a very gratifying feeling. And to see the danger of that, that sense of I intrinsically brings conceit, alienation, and the escape, like seeing through that, seeing that is just a concept, and letting go of that concept, then there's liberation, then there is freedom. Just as a final word, it was again on this note that it was almost sort of like a pair of bookends to my career in the university. It was, again, this in the last term before I left. I remember we were studying some of the books. I think it was by Eric Byrne who wrote Games People Play. Is that Eric Byrne? Yeah. And this was another book of his called Scripts People Live. Scripts People Live. And so we were been doing this for 2 or 3 weeks, and we were getting onto the part of about this is like describing how we create roles for ourselves, and we write our own scripts, and then we force ourselves to live according to the script that we've written or someone else has written for us. So then I was recognizing an awful lot of home truths in the descriptions about Eric Byrne, and thinking, yeah, I do that all the time, and yeah, why does this keep happening? And I don't like this, and what am I supposed to do about it? And we went on, you know, week after week, we were going into this stuff, and I'm just becoming fascinated by how true this all sounded. And then there's a whole succession of different things that can be done with your script, and I think the last two of a list of about 10 or 12 were to flip out of your script or to tear up your script, which means to decide, I don't want to live by this pattern, I don't want to be this way, and to flip out of your script is to step out of the role and to leave it completely, or to tear up your script is to just rip the thing to pieces and say, finished. So it was with Freud having set the ball rolling in 1974, in 77, when I came across Eric Byrne, and I thought, right, well, that's answered my question. I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to flip out of my script, tear it up, and go to Asia. So here I am. So anyway, I hope this wasn't too autobiographical, but I thought it would seem to be a more obvious theme for the talk than anything else, and I hope there's been some useful things in it for everyone. So we can finish there for the time being and break for some tea, and then we'll reconvene in a quarter of an hour or so.